He's chosen an unusual topic because deep. It's called backing up. Well, I don't know how much you can take on top of lasagna. In a sense, this is kind of a technical discourse, but we'll try to make it relatively light and technical. You have a chart I handed you. And this chart deals with that part of the book of Revelation that deals with the harvest period. And in our Revelation study in Louisville, we couldn't help but get a little bit excited about the simple layout. You know, you can always get lost in details when you study the volumes or when you study anything. Sometimes seeing the big picture is very elusive because you're looking at all the little details. So we'd kind of like to do some big picture looking with you. As you'll notice, this is numbered 1 through 5 down the left column because there are 5 views of the harvest period in Revelation. And they have remarkable similarities, even though they're all quite different in other respects. I'm calling it backing up because in my own study, I realized that all of these views ended up with something in common, and that was the destruction of Babylon. So in studying what was going on, I started at the end from the destruction of Babylon and worked forward. And it was extremely profitable. So I'm going to do that here. Let's go down the text there in the right-hand column, which is normally the end. We're going to use it as the beginning. And let's look at all the ways the destruction of Babylon is portrayed. The first harvest chapter is chapter 14. I think if you follow in your Bible, it'll have a couple advantages. Number one, it'll help keep you awake. Number two, your eyes seeing these things, it kind of fixes them in your mind a little bit better. Chapter 14, verse 20. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood came out from the winepress up to the horse's bridle for a distance of 200 miles. That translates. Anyway, there's one destruction of Babylon. Kind of interesting, before we go on to the next one, that it's done outside the city. Now, the only city mentioned in that chapter is Babylon. So Babylon is destroyed outside Babylon. And I think all of us know what that means. It gets destroyed in Israel. So the end events of Israel are tied together with the end events of Babylon. Babylon is not destroyed someplace in Babylon. It's destroyed outside the city, someplace that is not part of Babylon. And that, of course, is the final events surrounding Jerusalem and Israel. Okay, next one, 1619. And the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and Babylon the Great was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of his fierce wrath. So the second destruction of Babylon shows it as it's falling apart, divided into three parts, and then it gets to drink this apparently very unpleasant mixture of very fierce wrath. All right, this third one, 1716. And the 10 horns which you saw and the beast, these will hate the harlot and will make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire. So in this particular picture, how does Babylon go? Well, she gets eaten and burned. Not a very pretty picture. None of these is actually a very pretty picture. But as you can see, each time we reach the end of one of these things, Babylon is destroyed somehow. We'll come back and look a little more at how later. 1821. And a strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer. Cast into the sea with violence. That's pictured on the folder. And the last one, 1920. And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet, who performed the signs in his presence by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire which burns with brimstone. Nice thing about this picture is you see that Babylon does not have a slow diminishing fizzle out. Because they're cast alive in the lake of fire. So their destruction, they're still functioning just fine, and all of a sudden, bam, it's all over. Okay, that's the five pictures. Now, obviously, Babylon is not destroyed five times. It's only destroyed once. But this shows us that this whole center part of Revelation is devoted to looking at how Babylon meets its doom, different things that contribute to that doom, different things that help weaken it so that this ultimate destruction can happen. And so each one of these pictures, chapter 14 is one, 15 and 16 is another, 17 is another, 18 is another, the end of 19 is another, show us different views of the same event. Okay, now, let's back up just the column next to the end, because each one of these prophecies starts in the same place, too. Now, I found that very fascinating. Each one of these prophecies starts at the beginning of the harvest. Now, I don't know whether you can see the import of what this poem is doing here, but if you ever decide to study any part of Revelation, or if you are studying any part of it rather than the whole, just seeing how this is constructed is an immense help. You've got 5 years of the harvest starting at the beginning and ending with the destruction of Babylon. And so everything in between fills in the time. So every one of these views is going to start when the Lord returns and end once Babylon is totally destroyed. And therefore all the intervening verses simply fill in this century during which we have been alive. And it's very, very revealing as to what the symbols mean. Okay, let's back up next to the last column. Picture begins early in harvest as. Let's go back to chapter 14. Chapter 14 actually begins in the 6th verse. I saw an angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to preach to those who live on the earth, and to every nation and tribe and tongue of people. Okay, this vision of vision number one, you notice, starts with the preaching of the eternal gospel. You know when that happened. Brother Russell's work, wasn't it? And you can find a date here not too much farther in verse 8, can't we? Another angel, a second one, followed, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. We all know that the casting off of Babylon, the fall from favor, was 1878. So we've got 1874 and 1878 pretty well established there at the beginning of this vision. By the way, did you notice how many times it said Babylon's falling? Twice. Remember the lesson from this morning? Alpha and Omega, beginning and end, first and last. Three expressions, because that's the totality. It doesn't say Babylon is fallen, 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 for a very good reason. But the casting off in 1878 is not at the end. It's incomplete. The third part doesn't come until the end of the picture. Okay, let's go to the second picture. The one about the plagues. 15:5. After these things I looked, and the temple of the tabernacle of testimony was opened in heaven. Now, that's a weird expression, isn't it? Temple of the tabernacle Did you know the tabernacle had a temple? It does. Look on the chart.
Here we go. The temple of the tabernacle is the most holy room.
What's in there? The Ark of the Covenant. Not only represents the new covenant, but who administers it, how it's administered, what it all means. Basically, the whole divine plan, the church and Christ being the administrators of the new covenant. Okay, so it says here, I looked, and the temple, meaning the most holy, of the tabernacle of the testimony, was opened in heaven. What heaven? The earthly heaven, the religious world. Who opened it? Who taught you about the new covenant? Who taught you about the function of Christ in the church? Who taught you about the things that are beyond that veil which nobody could see beyond? That's Brother Russell, wasn't it? It was in 1874, nominally, that the temple of the tabernacle of testimony in heaven was opened. So again, this picture about the plague starts back there, 1874. We go a little further, verse 8. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no one was able to enter the temple until the seven plagues of the seven angels were finished. And at that point, if you're reading the story, you go, oh. Because you want it to be open, don't you? You want the new covenant to function. And here it says, sorry, I know you understand it. There it is, sitting so pretty. Sorry, no man can go in there until the plagues are pulled out. This is an 1878 verse. When you compare the verses in the Old Testament about the temple being filled with smoke and the tabernacle being filled with smoke, it represents something about the church. Now, sometimes we say it represents the completion of the church. Sometimes we say it means the glorification of the church. I think the latter phrase is better. It represents the glorification of the church. Not in its entirety, but what happened in 1878 when the saints went beyond the veil. So at this point, even though most of the church is there, even though the understanding of the covenant is what it's supposed to be, this verse says, no, no, no. You can't do it until the plagues are poured out. So there's a delay. Okay, that's picture number two there, showing us it starts with the beginning of the harvest. The third one, 17:1. And one of the angels who had the seven bowls came with me and spoke with me, saying, come here, I shall show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. Again, we mentioned this fellow this morning. And I think the placement there is just wonderful. You're reading through these plagues and probably getting all confused by them. And you notice they don't end very nice. Look at 16:21. Huge hailstones, men blaspheme God because of the plague of hail, because this plague was extremely severe. It doesn't end up nicely, does it? It leaves you hanging. And I think it does that on purpose, because the plagues kind of leave the world hanging. But right at this point, God says, don't worry, I have somebody that's going to show you what this is all about. It's the same thing as Matthew 24. I understand some of you have been studying Matthew 24. In Matthew 24, he said, what's the sign of your presence in the end of the age? And how did he end that chapter? He says, don't worry, there'll be somebody there to explain it. That's how that chapter ends. And actually, that's how this prophecy, this third view, begins. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot that sits on many waters. And Brother Russell did that. He's the first person in history to explain what Babylon was, how it functioned, and how it was going to end. In great detail. Okay, now I cannot pinpoint an 1878 verse in chapter 17, except when Brother Russell explained the fall of Babylon, he used 1878 and not as the casting off date. So it's sort of implied in the judgment of the great harlot that this one mentions. So either implied or stated so far, all of these prophecies have started with 1874 and 1878 dates. 18, chapter 1, chapter 18, verse 1. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. There's 1874, that is Jesus descending. By the way, notice what it says, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. I know prophetically most of us want to think of Jesus' glory being visible when the peaceable kingdom comes. But according to this verse, the earth was illumined with his glory in the 1870s. Now, it doesn't look like glory to most people, but boy, it looks like glory to us. When we look out the window and see prophecy being fulfilled and understanding that it is indeed glorious. Illumination of events of the earth. 18:2. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Notice that's the same thing we read in chapter 14. Again, not three of them, just two fallings. That's 1878. Not as well as verse 4, I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of their sins, and receive of her pain. 1878 date you have arrived at in your study. Okay. So this view also starts beginning of the harvest. And the final one. 1911. By the way, you might wonder about where did 19:1 through 10 go. That view in chapter 18 about the destruction of Babylon is the only one that carries events past the destruction. And it's really nice because the first 10 verses of chapter 19 show all the rejoicing that occurs after the destruction occurs. So it's a very lovely ending to that particular view of the harvest. It carries you beyond the veil as well as events on the earth of the church. Look how happy everybody is that Babylon has been cast into the midst of the sea. A wonderful event. So it ends with praise, and that's why chapter 19 should really start in the 11th verse. Okay, 11th verse. I saw heaven open. When did you see that? If you're John. You saw that in 1874, didn't you? And a white horse, pure doctrine. Now, if any of you know anything about Revelation, the last time we saw a white horse was back in the Ephesus period of the church, the first seal. Because that's the last time doctrine was pure. We have suddenly a new white horse on the scene. Doctrine has been purified in 1874 when the Lord sent his messenger to tell us all about it. Okay. 19 verse 14. The armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, and were following him on white horses. And as Brother Russell suggests, and I think it's most reasonable, the reason it's plural there is because at this point in time, early in the harvest, the saints are both beyond the veil and on this side of the veil. So verse 14 really is telling you 1878 and following, isn't it? The first time you get saints on the other side of the veil, 1878, the resurrection of the sleeping saints. That, by the way, does not continue throughout the prophecy. What is it? Wait a minute. Lost my place here. Oh yes, look at verse 19. All the beasts and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat upon the horse and against his... Oh, I mean, suddenly it's singular there, isn't it? That shows the church is complete. Notice little things like that when you study, huh? You have plural armies back in verse 14. You have a singular one in verse 19. Because by the time we get to verse 19, the church is all on the other side of the veil. And the army has become singular instead of plural. Okay. Now, what have we done? we've taken our two right-hand columns, we saw that each prophecy ends with the destruction of Babylon, each prophecy begins with the beginning of the harvest. Well, in essence, we could stop the talk right there. Because the point of the lesson is to realize that's how this whole section of Revelation is laid out. 5 years of the complete harvest period from one end to the other. But we won't stop totally. Okay, let's take the first two columns together and just sort of summarize what these five pictures are, and then we'll quit before the lasagna takes its effect. One thing you can do from the platform is talk too much. Okay. Let's go through these five now and just see sort of how they're laid out. You know how they begin, you know how they end. Let's see how they connect. That's our first two columns. Okay. As you notice, inclusive verses, chapter 14, 6 through chapter 14, 20. This whole picture of the harvest is there for one reason. It is to show you the harvest work's relationship to the decline and the fall of Babylon. Because both of these things are going on right here at the same time. The church is a great company of being dealt with, and the false church is falling apart. That's the point of harvest period. And that's what this chapter is about, to show you the relationship to the harvest work and the destruction of Babylon. Let's pick out just a couple highlights. We already saw at the beginning, we have the eternal gospel preached in verse 6. In verse 7, the saints are given a warning, basically, to worship God, not what they had been worshiping. And in verse 8, the call comes, it doesn't say come out of her, my people, but in essence it says it has been thrown off. If it's been thrown off, you don't want to have anything to do with it. Okay, then what happens? Verses 9 through 11, it's saying if you don't come out, look what's going to happen. If you keep worshiping the beast, the image, the mark, you're going to drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger, and you're going to be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. That means those who stay in are tormented. And we're watching that. It says it's in the presence of the holy angels and the Lamb. We are watching that. We realize that there are people out there who might like a better relationship with the Lord, and they are afraid to come out of that old dirty system. And they're tormented staying in. Unfortunately, they're not tormented quite enough to get out. But they're tormented, and it's reflected in the things they say. You know what they say. I'm a Lutheran, but I don't believe everything my church says. How many of you have never had anybody say that to you? Everybody's had it. Because they're tormented. What they've got doesn't fit. They're not quite ready to leave it, but it doesn't fit. And it's taken 100-some-odd years so far, hasn't it? And that's where verse 12 comes in. Here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. It's telling us you have to have patience for us. Basically 120 years so far, more than that. When we are watching this slow, pathetic disintegration of faith in the nominal church. And then it jumps back. I heard a voice from heaven saying, "What blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from henceforth." That's an 1878 date, isn't it? Because you will rest from your labors and your works will follow you. And then we see it focus in not on Babylon now, but on the harvest work. You see one on a white cloud sitting like the Son of Man, having a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And we have three angels after that. The first one's chronology. Verse 15. An angel came out of the temple, that's the plan of God, crying out with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in the sickle and reap, because the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe. Now, you notice that Jesus sitting on the cloud, isn't he? Who's going to tell Jesus what to do? There's only two possibilities. It could be God, but God wouldn't be shown here as an angel. So the only other thing that can tell Jesus what to do is the time. Jesus looked at his chronograph. He said, the time has come to reap. So he reaped. That angel is time. Chronology. He put in his sickle, and what happened? 16, he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. Translation, the church is done. Completely. You see, the harvest is divided into two parts here. By the way, that hasn't happened yet. He's still putting his sickle through the earth, and it's still being reaped, and verse 16 is not fulfilled. The church is not complete. But once it is, verse 17 happens. Another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven. He also had an sharp sickle. That's a good company for us. Notice what happens. Another angel, the one who has power over fire, came out from the altar. That's the church in glory. You know, when you're on the altar, you're burning. That's your sacrifice. When you come out from, you burn, you go under his ashes. When you come out from your altar, that's the church glorified. So the church glorified now is going to say something to great company. Verse 18. Put in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth because her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel swung his sickle to the earth, gathered the clusters of the vine of the earth, and threw them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. There is what the great company will do after the church is gone. It will do the final work of placing Babylon in a position so that Jesus can trample out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are still worth. You want to know what the great company is going to do? There it is. Revelation 14 divides the harvest into two clear parts. Complete the church, burn the tares. Well, it doesn't say burn the tares, it says crush the grapes. Pretty much the same thing under a different symbol. Okay, that's picture number one. Picture number two, chapters 15 and 16. Normally we just call these the plagues. But actually, what they are is historical events which weaken the apostasy throughout the harvest period. God's saying, let's go back, look once more, and see how Babylon is slowly weakened throughout this process. Because we haven't covered that yet. Chapter 14 didn't do that. And so chapter 15 tells you about events that are as they are at the beginning of the harvest period. And chapter 16 says, I'm going to give to these seven angels something they can pour out that's going to make it happen. I think these seven angels are the same seven messengers that blew the trumpets. And I think the reason for that is, go back and read the trumpets, and you'll notice the trumpets and the plagues are aimed at the same thing. First one at the earth, second one at the sea, third one at the fountains, it goes on and on. But what happened when those angels blew their trumpets back during the age? The world, did you undo something? Ignore it. There it is. And God said, they shouldn't have done that. I will now give you something better than the trumpet. So he gives them a vial, which I think is a container, something that holds these truths in a much more powerful way. I think they represent events, historical events. And he says, you go splash this on them and see what happens. And the thing the trumpet could not accomplish, the plague does. And I think we can go right through the harvest saying plague number one is the First World War that caused governmental security to perish. It gives them this running sore they can't cure. Plague number two is probably the Bolshevik Revolution, which starts dividing the sea class into groups that caught and groups that don't. Plague number three is probably, this is funny, the Jehovah's Witness movement, which knocked everybody's door and said, don't drink blood. And they said, the doctrine you're drinking is bloody. You know, because we're so close to it, we tend to ignore it. But there has been no religious movement on the face of the earth ever since maybe the times of the apostles. It has had a bigger effect on the world than the Jehovah's Witnesses. They have knocked on almost every door in the world. And whether the people listen or not is immaterial. They were spreading ideas and questions. They've been a plague on the ideas of Babylon. Then plague number four comes along. That was probably the Second World War, where people's faith was burned by the Holocaust, by the atomic weapons. Then comes plague number five, which is probably Vatican II, which turned Catholicism into a confusing world, where the bishops are criticizing and questioning the Pope, and their stability is just all falling apart. Then comes plague number six, which I think we're in the middle of. And I think it's the information explosion. Not just television and radio, but probably also internets on computers. The fact is, there is so much information going everywhere so fast that people can't handle it. And it is really making questions and doubts and all kinds of insecurities rise to the top. There is so much information so fast it is setting so many people's heads awhirl that their confidence in everything is going right down the drain. That's plague number six. Although it's more complicated than that. Plague number seven hasn't happened yet. But I suspect as soon as it starts, we'll be on the other side, because verse 17 says, a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne saying, it is done. And the true church will be with Jesus beyond the veil, the door will be shut, and Babylon will fall, as the great company helps it to fall. Okay, that's picture number two. Picture number three, the political events, chapter 17. First of all, the chapter describes Babylon, and the rest of it is dealing with heads and horns and beasts and all kinds of things we don't have time to get into right now. But the point of it is, it's the relationship between politics and the social world. Heads and horns and beasts have to do with the relationship of governmental power and of people's reactions to these political movements, which eventually will turn on Babylon and be one of the factors, one of the five factors at least, in her destruction, so that the chapter finally ends, the ten horns and the beast will hate the harlot, will make her desolate and naked, will eat her flesh and burn her up with fire. So there will be a political injustice. Verse 4, the economic developments. We noticed a little while ago, 1804 is an 1878 day, this has come out of from my people. We also noticed that the end of it is verse 21, a strong angel takes up a millstone and throws it with violence into the sea and saying Babylon won't be found any longer. So the chapter covers there, 1878, until some future date when you can't find Babylon anymore. Therefore, everything in between those two verses has been going on for the last 100 years. Maybe we haven't seen it. But this divides people up into kings of the earth and merchants of the earth and shipmasters and passengers and sailors. It's talking about economic interests. Economic interests have been greatly harmed by the events of this century. The wealthy used to loan money to kings. The kings are too unstable now, if you can even find one. So what do? You know what Mr. Nixon did. Who did Mr. Nixon take when he went to China? He took David Rockefeller. I think that's strange. One of the great capitalists of the world. And they had to introduce a new word into the Chinese vocabulary. Credit. Almost a quarter of the world's population lives in China. And you see, what's happening now is because the old ways of commerce have been foiled because Babylon's own system has been diminishing and falling apart. They're looking for a new way. And so they don't deal with kings now. They deal with you and me and charge us 18% on our credit cards. So that's just as well. God, we don't have the power that kings had, so they really have a hold over us. Anyway, chapter 18 is dealing with that diminishing old order and the attempts at finding ways of replacing it, which is not going to work. It's going to end up with Babylon being thrown down in a great pit of violence. And chapter 19, it says, hallelujah, 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 it's gone. And the last view, chapter 19, starting verse 11. This I call the spiritual view, because this really deals with the way that you and I have looked at the harvest period. We have seen heaven open. We have seen the white horse. We have known his name to be faithful and true. We know that what's going on in the world is him in righteousness judging and waging war. We know about his eyes. We know about his crown. We know about his robe. We know what's going on. We even know in verse 14 that our brethren are already beyond the veil and we're trying to cooperate in what's going on. We know that the sharp sword is making its, in verse 15, is making its imprint, and that eventually it will eventuate in the treading of the winepress, as we saw in chapter 16. We also know in verses 17 and 18 a tremendous similarity to the description in Ezekiel about the destruction or the attempted destruction of Israel. You know, in Ezekiel it talks about the horses and eating them up and all that stuff with the birds. Almost an exact quote, but it's extremely different because in Ezekiel it's about Israel, isn't it? Attacking Israel's invaders. Here it is about Babylon. And you remember what we saw in chapter 15? No, it wasn't 15. Chapter 14. That Babylon is trodden without the city. In Israel. And that's why there's this tremendous similarity here between the destruction of Israel and the destruction of Babylon. They're contemporaneous. And they're even in the same place. Babylon somehow is going to meet its end by events in Israel. And then what happens, verse 19, the beast, into the earth, assembled to make war against him, and it doesn't work. They get thrown alive into the lake of fire. What a wonderful thing. By the way, anybody among you who has done any study in Revelation, if I mention beast and false prophet as 19:20 does, it's probably going to carry you back to chapter 16 because they were mentioned with a third character, weren't they? Beast what in false prophet? Dragon. So you've got to say, where's the dragon? The beast and the false prophet get thrown into the lake of fire here. Where's the dragon? He's in chapter 20. Chapter 20 deals with the dragon. He gets bound for 1,000 years until you get to verse 10. The devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet already are. So that takes us into the millennium, and that's beyond our subject, and so we're finished. 5 views of the harvest period made clearer by backing up. Starting from each description of how Babylon is destroyed, backing up to how it begins at the beginning of the harvest, and that is Revelation made simple. May the Lord have his blessing.